Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. Okay, so now I'm pretty into family lore, or maybe let's say statute of limitations have run out and people are ready to speak. It's kind of the theme of this episode on skyjacking. The era where 1 week, sometimes two in one day, would occur in the late 60s and early 70s. So, lovely listeners and friends, I'm calling for a listener stories episode that includes family secrets. And this can span so many areas, and people can also remain completely anonymous. So, calling for your stories, send them to 7deadlysinnerspodcast@gmail.com. Did you find a hidden stash of cash, maybe, after your grandparent died? Did someone come out of the woodwork and reveal a secret mystery that you didn't know? Or maybe a crime, and again, you can remain anonymous. Did your grandpa or grandma confess to something on their deathbed? To maybe being D.B. Cooper? Well, yeah, because that seemed to happen a lot for this infamous case. So I'd love to put another listener stories episode together, and this one I'm going to deem family secrets, lore, and maybe hauntings. It's up to you guys, please send them in, and thank you for listening. Now on to the story. One enduring story of lore and the infamous was D.B. Cooper, who successfully evaded capture, or died while trying, remains the only unsolved skyjacking in American history. And to say it became an obsession for law enforcement, citizen sleuths, the public, would be an understatement. To this day, as in literally last week, and I didn't plan for this, guys, D.B. Cooper's identity may have been re-revealed, because this guy was one of the original suspects. So, for over 50 years, suspect after suspect, family member who believes DB is their relative, everyone was coming forward, people who confessed on their deathbed. Many elusive suspects have been cornered or boldly bragged about being DB Cooper. So let's look at some of those now and then dive into the one that just came out. And by the way, I hope you enjoyed your Thanksgiving. Thank you for listening, and I love you guys. But I can tell you some people that didn't enjoy their Thanksgiving in 1971. And that would be the people on the delayed flight from Portland to SeaTac, where a hijacker dressed as a businessman took their lives into his own hands by bringing a bomb on board and making excessive demands. So he jumps out of a 727 in the dark of night, in bad weather. The Pacific Northwest is notorious for a few things. Bad weather and thick wilderness. Huge trees and underbrush where D.B. Cooper may have jumped makes this story even more mysterious and frustrating. There's also 5 fighter jets sent to track the plane, but they couldn't keep pace because they weren't designed to go as slow as D.B. demanded that the pilots did. Many in law enforcement, and I will say that they would kind of go back and forth on this, but it feels like their main theory is that he wouldn't have been able to survive that jump. He jumped in terrible weather conditions, so bad that they couldn't even search for him. Then it started snowing the next day. They got about 6 inches of snow, and it was just too difficult for them to even look for this infamous man that could have been hanging in a tree somewhere. So my conclusion in this, and we'll go through a few of the suspects, but my conclusion in this is either D.B. Cooper died during that jump, or he was Richard McCoy. According to the recently released articles on both Yahoo News, New York Post, and many other news outlets, in a quote from Yahoo News, the children of convicted skyjacker Richard McCoy II believe their dear old dad may have been D.B. Cooper. The notorious and notoriously unidentified central figure in 1971's unsolved skyjacking, in its only one in the United States history, the only unsolved one. In fact, without an answer until perhaps now. Just months after the Cooper incident, McCoy was convicted of an incredibly similar skyjacking that also included a parachute jump. And his children have long thought that these clues added up. And they may now have the evidence to back it up. His kids, Shantae and Rick, had kept quiet out of consideration for their mother, Karen, who they believe was potentially complicit in both crimes. But as both parents are now deceased, the opportunity arose for the siblings to come forward with their suspicions. And crucially, they seem to have had hard evidence, a modified parachute that they and amateur D.B. Cooper sleuth Dan Grider believed was used in the daring escape. Quote, "That rig is literally one in a billion," Grider told Cowboy State Daily after releasing a series on YouTube about his suspicions. According to Grider, the FBI now has that parachute and harness that were once tucked away in a storage shed on the family property in North Carolina, along with a harness and skydiving logbook that Shantae claims show D.B. Cooper's movements near Oregon and Utah, the locations of the two skyjacking events. This is the first real movement from the FBI on the case since the Bureau closed it in 2016. But they literally kept it open, Greg. This is crazy. They were so obsessed with solving this, which part of me, I mean, we talked about this in the prior episodes, but part of me is like, I mean, it was just $200,000 and like, well, he didn't kill anyone. Like, let it go. But it really meant something to at least Ralph Hemmenbach, it's hard to say his last name, that FBI agent that really stuck with this.
They don't want outlaws getting away with crimes. It's not about the money. It's about the clout, really. They don't want, you know, folk heroes. Like, a guy fought the law and the law lost.
Yeah.
And they just can't.
Yeah, they
stand
can't.
Stand it.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe that's what it is. And maybe it also is when you really think about it. And I thought a lot about it because I had a couple friends that were former flight attendants. They're not flight attendants anymore, but they put up a lot of time with Alaska Airlines and in the Pacific Northwest. And they also know, like, we're from the Pacific Northwest. Especially when it's described that he jumped into, like, the thick wilderness. I'm like, oh, I know exactly what that looks like. My dad was a logger. Like, I know the woods. Like,
there's some serious, it's crazy out there. Like, you can't even see 10 feet into the woods.
Yeah. Like, let me just give you a quick example of how big some trees that, like, my dad fell when he was logging. My dad's probably 5'11", whatever. And
give him 6 foot.
It's never been that, but whatever. The Daily Historian called him 5'10" in when he was playing baseball in high school, and he's like, I'm suing him.
Misprint.
He didn't say he was going to sue him. He said that's a misprint. But so just picture, like, you know, like a average size male. So my dad and let's call the other guy that was logging with him that day. So basically, they cut a wedge out of a tree. So that's, and then you fall it. Hard to explain. But my dad and the other dude are laying head to head in this tree in a photo. So that would make the diameter of that tree, let's go 12 feet.
That's pretty good math. Yeah, I'd say at the very least 12 feet. Could have been 13.
Yeah.
I've seen that photo.
Yeah, they're huge trees.
These are dinosaur trees.
Yeah. Big trees.
But, you know, maybe they've got big soft canopies that you could land in with a parachute. You just never know.
Maybe. I mean, I don't know. I spent a ton of time in those woods. I used to walk jobs for my dad at certain points, like
Junior.
Yeah. I mean, it is possible that and they even say it in the really amazing podcast, Infamous America. Amazing. Please go listen to it and go listen to Legends of the Old West. That at least in their writing that possibly the FBI agent was like, all right, we'll wait till the next, like, deer season and we'll find him, like, perhaps deceased, like hanging in a tree, basically
come
like
across him.
Yeah, they're gonna put a deer stand up and.
Yeah, it makes sense, but no one ever found him hanging from a tree. I think he lived. I'm a big D.B. Cooper lived guy now.
I am very 50-50. I think he could be Richard McCoy.
The real McCoy.
Yes, but I kind of want to go with what my friend, former flight attendant, Derek Danzel believes. So I interviewed him because I wanted to know what it was like. Because thinking about it, like, yeah, he's like, D.B. Cooper's like a folklore sort of like hero to some people. You know, like, oh, it's like he's sticking it to the man. That did sort of change after 9/11. People were like, oh, okay, it's an act of terrorism now, it seems like.
In its heyday, he was getting features in Kid Rock songs.
True. That's true. But at the same time, those flight attendants that were essentially held hostage, I mean, they have real trauma. So I wanted to ask my friend, you know, what would that be like? Like, what's the whole protocol with this? And so we're going to hear from Derek right now.
What's up, fam?
Okay. So, do you know who D.B. Cooper is? And it's
of
okay
course.
If you don't. You do?
What do you mean, do I know who D.B. Are you? Is anyone you asked that question to trapped under a fucking rock?
Really? I didn't know who he was until I, like, knew about it in the last, like, couple weeks.
D.B. Cooper, are you shitting me? You didn't know who that was?
Okay, tell me what you think who you think D.B. Cooper is, but then I have some flight attendant questions for you.
I don't necessarily know, like, have a good idea who he is, but I know a lot about him.
Well, no one knows who he is. He's not. It's unsolved still. Although it did come out this last week, which is fucking crazy, with that I decided to do a 3-part series on him just this week. They think that they have now actually found him, but it for like 50 something years it was unsolved. Okay,
can I get? Go ahead. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was gonna say I don't know how your like brain. I'm assuming is this a subject of your podcast, B. Cooper?
Yeah, I'm
you
just
know,
doing 3 parts on him.
I don't know how your like brainstorming sessions go when you think of topics, but have you thought about maybe making the Barefoot Bandit a topic of discussion?
That's that kid that stole the planes?
Stole like 10 planes.
Yeah, he was a kid, right?
Yes, he was a 15-year-old kid, and he kept crashing the planes because they ran out of gas. So check
yes.
this out. So check this out. So on page like 9 or 10 of the Daily Astorian one day, they're saying like a boat house got broken into, you know, and tampered with. And it was like a tongue-in-cheek joke, like maybe it's the Barefoot Bandit, like what? and that's what it was, right? So that was on like page 9 or 10 of the Daily Astorian. A week later,
God, you're blowing my mind because I know this story. I didn't had no
listen
idea.
To me,
I had to
listen
involve.
To me. Listen to me. So a week later, front page, in all italics, it says it was the Barefoot Bandit. It was the kid. He was trying to steal something out of Warrenton, Oregon.
In Warrenton?
Swear to God.
What? How? What area?
You'll have to Google it. Like, obviously, if the Daily Astorian wrote it, it's Googleable.
I'm fucking freaking out right now.
I have. So, hold up. Okay, I'll send you a picture that I have. Where is it?
Right now.
So
because I
kind of want
to do, like, I'm going to probably do maybe 2 more episodes about skyjackings. Because I'm just really into him right now. Greg's got one he's real into, too, this Martin McNally one. But that's the Barefoot Bandit with an Astoria is blowing my fucking mind.
So I just bought – I just sent you this picture. I just bought this book that's
okay.
all about him. And I think – so he's since been captured, since served time, and I think he's a free man right now. But, yeah.
Was he
so,
captured
I mean,
when he was a teenager still?
I think so, like around 18 or 19 or something like that. But, like –
uh-huh.
I mean, think about a conversation like, oh, my God, wouldn't that have been crazy if it was, like, the Barefoot Bandit and then, like, literally front page. Oh, my God, it actually was him.
That's insane.
Yeah.
And so and he stole. Wait, he tried to steal a plane in. Oh, because we have that small airport around there.
Yeah. Yeah, he was stealing whatever he could steal, and it was like throughout the Northwest. So he made his way to Astoria.
That's insane. Where else could you be stationed besides Camp Rialia?
I don't know, but at that age, if he would have set foot in the Warrington City Park, he would have got crossed on the basketball court. I would have whipped his ass because that's where I was.
What it would like to be, like, the immense amount of pressure put on a flight attendant. Like, so basically in the D.B. Cooper incidents, and let me give you, like, another quick backstory. So in 1971, but the years from 1968 to, like, 1974, I think, there was literally a skyjacking pretty much a day, sometimes twice in a day. It was a very bizarre time that people were just getting on planes and whatever. And so people like you were just having to just deal with someone saying they have a bomb on a plane or, you know, whatever. There was even weird scenarios in which, like, some students were, like, they didn't want to take their, like, final exams in college. And they were like, we're going to just handle it this way. So picture that scenario. So D.B. Cooper, he boarded a plane. There were three female flight attendants on the plane, and he basically passed one of them a note that she thought was like him hitting on her, and so she didn't read it. And then he waited 20 minutes or something, and then he said, "Miss, you should read that note. I have a bomb." So she read it, blah, 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 blah. So my first question is that pressure still on flight attendants to, like, do you really have to handle that sort of, like, how do you handle that scenario?
Am I going to be on air?
Yeah, if you want to be.
Okay, first things first, shout out. I'm just kidding. Okay, where do you want me to start? I can go in eight different directions.
You can start anywhere you want to, and Greg edits all of this, so.
Perfect. Okay, so I'll start from the beginning and give you what I can give you. So, hey, my name is Derek. I was a flight attendant from 2013 to 2020 until I took my promotion onto the corporate side. So I guess what I can tell you is in our flight manual, it does have this verbatimly that a flight attendant must protect the flight deck with their life. It says that verbatimly in our flight attendant manual. Everything post 9/11 is incredibly planned and kind of almost workshopped. That's not the right term, because when, like, we try and, you know, work out jokes, that's called workshop, but like everything is tested through the FAA and trial and error, and there are protocols and what our companies and the TSA called the Swiss cheese model. So there is at any given time 9 or 10 different, you know, quote unquote agencies looking at security. So my company.
Sorry, can I interrupt you? What different agencies? Because this is very interesting, and you're doing a fantastic job. It's very interesting because in 1971, this guy could just – he sauntered onto the plane, like, with a fake name. Like, he could have just probably held a gun in his hand and no one would have really cared. So what are the several different agencies?
So the Federal Air Marshal Service is a federal agency. It's a standalone service. So that's – the Department of Homeland Security, which was founded post 9/11, is where the TSA comes from. And then Alaska and Horizon Airline, the company that I used to work for, has their own security. So that's at least three of them. I know the Department of Defense is the fourth one, and there is maybe a couple more, but those are the four that come off the top of my head. the only way to be able to bring a weapon or have any, it would be impossible to do from the outside. You would need inside help. And in fact, do you know that one of our planes?
In this day and age, you're saying.
Yeah. Do you know that one of our planes got hijacked in 2018 by a ground agent?
What? That you were.
One from my own company.
Oh my God.
So his name was Richard Russell. He was my age. He was a ground agent. He took the ground agents sometimes taxi planes from like the hangar to spots, parking spots, and then it gets set up for boarding and takeoff. He took it by himself, and there's transcripts between the FAA and him talking, saying like, "Rich, why don't you bring the plane back?" And he's like, "I can't do that," and kind of flies it and crashes it.
Oh my God!
So
people on board?
No, just him. This was in 2018.
God.
This was my company. So here's
Eric, you are the most fascinating guest I've ever had. Thank you.
I know. So
I know. I'm aware, and I have good hair.
Yeah.
They know about your hair.
Fantastic hair. You better put a picture of it. Do you remember 2017 or 18, there was an airline called German Wings where it made world headlines because the pilots very slowly descended into a mountain on purpose, killing everyone. The reason I bring that up is he was able to do that by himself because he was in the cockpit by himself, which would never happen with any airline inside of the United States of America. So there are protocols when there are two pilots in there. If a pilot needs to take a piss, he calls and says, "Hey, I got to use the lav," comes out, flight attendant A goes up, then the cabin door closes. So at any given time, there's always at least two people inside the cockpit. After he's done,
is it the responsibility of the first officer to defend the cockpit with his life if the pilot tries to?
Yeah. So what kind of they didn't realize was, they made it where you can't breach a cabin from the outside. So once that pilot left the cockpit and the remaining pilot locked it and decided to descend, there was no getting to him. So my point is when that kind of happened, we all were like, the protocol that we have, that'll never happen. And that's second nature. That happens all the time. That's actually one of my favorite parts of being a flight attendant. It was like, we'd be coming from Canada, and one of the, pilots was like, "Oh, I got to hit the lav for 5 minutes." And I'd go up there and just stare at the Canadian Rockies for as far as I could see. And it was just, it's a different point of view that, never get – when you nerd out like that, you never get sick of those views. So there are certain protocols where that would have never happened. There would have never – even if there was a pilot from our airline that wanted to do something bad, he would have never gotten a chance because of our protocols in place. There are so many checks and balances in place that it would be almost damn near impossible for a DB Cooper today from the outside to do what he did today.
And now enter Martin McNally. Inspired by the renegade story of DB Cooper, a young Martin McNally, who was a small-time crook, decides he wants to get in on this game. Martin was born in Trenton, Michigan in 1944. He was one of eight kids, a middle child, who knew right away that he liked living on the edge. He said he was very money motivated and risk averse. And I'm not referring to the stock market. I'm referring to finding any way on the streets or in the skies to make money. After failing out of school, he called up the Navy recruiter and asked to join. And so he did. In 1961, he began his military career. And a few experiences would make him ripe to pull off a skyjacking. Number one, he was an electrician on flights, so he learned the airplane in and out because of his job. It involved crawling from the flight deck into the bowels of the airplane. Number two, they put him through escape and evasion training. It's kind of like,
jumping out of planes.
Yeah.
Probably, yeah.
There was something about, like, pouring water on him, too.
He's tough.
This is from American Skyjacker, also a great podcast.
Yeah,
that's where I got this info, and that's where Greg got obsessed with McNally.
It's true.
Yeah, and number three, he learned how to jump out of an airplane and had no fear about it, but I won't say that he didn't have fear of airplanes completely. He was bold. He was a bold criminal, but he had two experiences while in the military that really scared him. So his time in the military, he witnessed two plane crashes near his base. One, he went to rescue the men on the plane, but when he got there, the men were burning alive, which is horrifying. And the second one, that he was supposed to be on that flight, but instead was working on the ground due to a knee injury. But the people were from his own unit. So it was friends of his that passed away. So eventually he was discharged from the Navy and he went back to Michigan, and he found it hard to integrate into civilian life. Like, he wasn't the, like, stay at home dad type, or the, like 9 to 5.
Wasn't getting his kicks. Needed a good get-rich-quick scheme.
Exactly. And he started running scams immediately upon returning to Michigan. So he was actually stationed in Alaska. That's where those accidents happened. And he got arrested once, but he didn't spend that much time in jail. And then one day he's driving around with his buddy, and the D.B. Cooper story comes on the radio. And that moment changed him forever. He wanted to follow in DB's footsteps. This guy had this thing called life and making money figured out. It was the correct score. That's what he says in the documentary. Something like, not correct score. It was like
the right score.
Yeah, something like that.
Quick, fast, bold.
Yeah.
I know. I remember listening to that, you know, because they interview him in... what's the podcast called?
American Skyjacker.
American Skyjacker.
Yeah, he's in every episode. I mean, he's boldly
telling
and
you his
he's honest.
It's incredible. Highly recommend checking it out. But yeah, when he's talking about that, that's when it hit me. Like, that he got his dream. He got his.
Like, that's the guy. That guy. That's
the
right score.
This will be easy.
Not these like counterfeit quarters he's putting through. I don't know if it was an alarm.
Yeah, he was doing like a counterfeit quarters, like vending machine scam.
Something.
Nah,
yeah,
I know.
There was a lot of like low level.
He's like a parachute.
Yeah. And do you know how
one
he
jump,
learned?
200 grand.
Do you know how? Nope. Well, here's what's crazy. Number one. He actually didn't learn how to jump out of a plane, apparently, in the military. I thought that until I was re-researching it. And then you hear him say he goes to the library for like 4 hours or whatever and does some research on it. How to jump out of a plane.
Local library.
Pretty sure he never had answers before. Just.
I think that's correct.
Yeah. So
he's an electrician. He's just on the ground.
He just has bold confidence. I mean, I love a confident person. I don't love, you know, crimes and like scaring people or whatever, but it just
criminal
it just,
or not, if you got confidence, you know, you're welcome in Rachel's circle.
You're the leader. You're Father Yod. You're the leader of the Source cult. Even though I don't like cults, I kind of was into Father Yod. I don't know. Okay, I'm not influencing the youth of America correctly.
I think you do like cults. But
I'm fascinated by,
there you go.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by just like where do you get off? Like where does that confidence come from?
But back to the cult.
Okay.
Of skyjacking.
Okay. Yeah, it essentially was
took a lot of confidence.
It was not a disease, like a contagion. Like it like kind of, but that's kind of culty. Like it went viral. There
viral.
We go.
Early 70s viral.
There we go. Love it.
If you didn't skyjack in the 70s.
What were you doing?
What were you
besides
doing?
Besides cocaine in Studio 64.
I believe it's 54. Studio 54.
Shit, you're correct.
64. Nintendo 64.
That's what I was thinking of.
Hey, we play a lot of Blitz.
That's what I was doing in junior high, was playing a lot of Blitz and stuff. But when I bring up junior high, I'm only bringing that up because I did write Studio 54 into my junior high prophecy, what I was going to do with my life. So I'm surprised I couldn't remember what it was. All right. So this guy is learning how to parachute from the library, like just reading books, like, all right, I'm going to jump out of a plane. Just, I spent 4 hours. I did.
Makes me like Martin McNally even more.
Greg loves him because he landed in Indiana. We'll get there.
It's about all it takes.
Yeah. Anything Indiana is all it takes. So when putting this plan together, he tried to recruit an accomplice, a buddy, to go with him on this mission. And the buddy was initially in, but he bailed last minute. He said, this is too big, too scary, too much. I ain't doing this. I'm not Shooter McGavin like you. I don't have the confidence. I'm not the cock on the walk like you are.
Didn't find the Luigi to his Mario.
Yeah, I mean, well, he still offered to be his chauffeur, which you'll hear about.
Okay. So
his plan gets delayed for a few months because he's, okay, the accomplice is out, whatever, you know.
Got to recalculate.
Yeah, exactly. But eventually he wanted to rip the Band-Aid off and just go through with it. He was like, I got to do this. He tells his buddy, okay, I understand. I'll give you $25,000 in cash, assuming that the $500,000 that he requests on the plane. So he upped the ante from D.B. Cooper. It was D.B. Cooper was 200. He was like, I'm going to go five. So assuming that the $500,000 came through, he said, I'm going to give you $25,000 in cash if you will be my chauffeur. Shuttle me from Detroit to St. Louis and be available if anything happens. I said, okay, I'll do that. At this point, it was the ticketing agent's responsibility to do some sort of profiling to see if there was suspicious behavior, the person seemed off. And Martin McNally knew, like, okay, dress proper, like, get yourself together, just look as smooth as possible. But you'll hear in a little bit, though, is what he looked like when he was on the plane, which was a stark contrast, but the responsibility put on the flight crews, ticketing agents, is pretty insane. And Derek has a lot of insight on that.
Yeah. And there are four levels of threats that we assess. There's level one, level two, level three, and level four. Level one is verbal abuse. If I'm your flight attendant, Rachel, and you've had one too many drinks and I cut you off and you're like, my mom is going to sue the shit out of you, we call it a level one, like, threat risk. Level two is you pinching me on my arm, you creating contact, you saying, hey, if you don't serve me again, like, it's going to be a real fucking problem. Level three.
Does that actually happen?
All the time. Level three is you brandishing a weapon. Level four
is just a level three? Brandishing a weapon is a level three?
Level four is you making a threat to the safety of the aircraft. The flight deck will shut down at level one. So if you get surly, the flight deck shuts down. Like, that's how serious, like, the safety is taken on board.
Oh, so for insults, it will shut down.
100%. But
so at a certain point, one of the flight attendants looks at the back of the plane, and there is a man with a wig, dark glasses, medical gloves on, and a sawed-off machine gun.
Discreet. What could this guy be up to?
Yeah. I feel like D.B. Cooper was like, he slid a note. This guy was like, I'm going to stand here. Basically.
Getting ready for vacation.
Yeah.
I don't understand the medical gloves after the fact. Like, you came onto the plane.
Well, I was thinking it was like fingerprints. Because I thought about that at first,
well, yeah,
too. I was like, what?
That's what I'm saying. Like, if he didn't have him on when he came on initially, his fingerprints are already on the plane.
Yeah, I'm a little confused about this part. Is like, did he change or did he enter the...
Martin.
Because in his interviews on American Skyjacker, he's like, yeah, I wanted to look my best. And then in another episode, you hear a flight attendant saying, a man with a wig. And I'm like, well, I don't, what? Did you enter? Like,
I think he, if anyone was able to photograph him after the fact, he didn't want to be recognized. So, you know, he went with a disguise.
Well, and he was also very specific about photographs. He had everyone on the plane that had cameras. He, well, I guess you put them up to light or whatever to like expose them. So like they couldn't.
Burned out all the negatives.
Yep.
Smart, and, Martin. Smart.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's a self-admitted low-level criminal. Like he said, he wasn't that great at it. Like he had other buddies that were better at stuff like this, but he was, I mean, fairly well planned.
But a prime time skyjacker.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, fairly well planned because at a certain point, he says that all the women and children can get off the plane. Anyone with a medical condition, whatever.
I'd be fake. I'd be, oh, yeah.
And like,
I've got Tourette's. You don't want me on 26 here.
26 people did say.
Got Tourette right here.
Well, it was very specific about a heart condition. And like, I think it was like 26 people were like, I got a heart condition.
Yeah.
And he was like, bullshit. Like, he called their bluff.
Oh, Martin.
Yeah. Some guy that looked like a football player, essentially, like he says this in his interviews, like tried to like sort of confront him. And he's like, you're off the plane. Get up. Nope. You ain't gonna stop
me.
You're
gone.
Yep. You're gone.
Fired.
But he kept 13 people on because to keep hostages, it's like they're not gonna
shoot the plane down.
They had snipers on like the roof of one of the airports or whatever, but like he knew that if he put the hostages sort of like
in
the way.
Oh, that's why he's wearing the wig. So like through the window, they'd be like, oh.
Yeah, there he is.
It's one of the regular passengers.
It's a lady. Is she on The Real Housewives? I'm picturing like a long wig. The whole wig thing
more
is
like
confusing to me.
The Real Hostages.
Yeah, maybe.
Of Martin McNally skyjacking.
I have no idea what his wig was. Maybe he wore like a men's wig, but I don't know why I'm picturing like a long blonde curly wig.
Yeah.
That's just my vision and my dream in life.
I was imagining long and blonde.
Yeah. So he's sending these demands to the cockpit, okay? And the authorities are gathering at the airport and there are snipers on the roof of the airport. So not only just regular authorities, the FBI, they have a slow play with the delivery of the money.
The old slow play.
But oddly enough, similar to D.B. Cooper, the flight attendants didn't appear to be really afraid of him. Like, remember in the D.B. Cooper, you know, story, she was like, he was nice. He was polite. She shared a cigarette with him. Like, he didn't, like, scare her. They say the same thing about Martin McNally. Like, he wasn't, like, scary. How the blonde wig and medical gloves.
Other than looking like Sammy Hagar.
Yeah.
On a beach vacation.
That was funny. And
I realized that's who I was picturing.
Yeah, like I don't know why that's why I'm picturing too.
I'm
it's
seeing
just
a Hawaiian
like,
t-shirt too, even though it's probably not that.
But
we're getting skyjacked.
But what's hilarious too, though, and not hilarious because it must have been terrifying, but like, oh no, he wasn't really that scary. He literally sawed off. They say a machine gun in some of these articles, but he's personally says in interviews that he cut 12 inches or something off of
a
rifle.
That, yeah.
Yeah. But like, how a guy in a wig with gloves on and a sawed off gun. Oh, he was super polite. He was nice. He asked for drinks. He said thank you. I think they even said, they were like, oh, he always said thank you. And okay.
Yeah, use his manners.
Well, I mean.
Hey, just because you're skyjacking doesn't mean you can't be polite.
Fair enough. So, to cut a long story short, he pulls a D.B. Cooper. He jumps out of the plane. And we know he survived. We don't know if D.B. survived.
He lost the money, though. Like,
yes.
Nearly immediately upon jumping out of the plane. Boom, briefcase, whatever he had it in, just goes, poof. He loses control of it, lost it. And this is my favorite part of the story, because it landed in a farmer's field in Indiana. And like, that guy could have just taken the money, buried it in his barn, and had gas and groceries, you know, for the next two generations of his family. But no, he turns it into authorities. And then Martin McNally is on the road in, you know, middle of nowhere, Indiana, farmland.
It's called like Peru, I think, Indiana or something. I don't know.
Ooh, Peru. I know exactly where Peru is.
Is that a real town?
Yeah, absolutely.
I got it right? Okay.
That's crazy. We have a Peru and a Brazil, Indiana. Anyhow, that's
don't mean
neither
to brag,
here
or
there.
Wow.
They don't look like either of those countries. It just looks like cornfields and more cornfields. But Martin McNally is beat up from not landing very well with his parachute and walking down a county road in the middle of nowhere, farm country, Indiana. And who else but the local sheriff pulls up? And he talks himself out of it. He's like, oh, I got in a fight with my...
He actually names a person. I think he pulled it out of his ass. He said, yeah. Hillary Johnson. And the yeah. cop was like, I think I know who that is. And I think he said he got in a fight with his brother-in-law or something. Like Hillary's
he made it
brother.
All in-laws, which was smart. So his name didn't, you know, attach. He showed him an ID, or maybe he didn't show him an ID, but he told him.
He showed him. He said, like,
he had a fake ID.
He had credit cards that were his brother's. He was like, well, my brother lets me use these. And then it's all a little confusing. Somehow or another,
the sheriff bought the story and drove him to town, beat up after falling from an airplane.
But may I just say one thing? He was off duty at the time, and his wife was in his patrol vehicle. So he rides in...
with the wife. Gets himself a hotel. Then the place starts crawling with cops. The FBI figures out, you know, zeroes in on the location. All the government agencies are there. CIA, FBI, local cops, you know, probably the IPD, Indianapolis police, you know, state police. Crawling with cops. And Martin McNally stays in his hotel room for like 3 days. Shaves his head. Shaves his face. And waits until the right time to slink out and get into a car of his buddy that he called from the front desk, none other, down from Michigan to come pick him up. And he...
bat out of hell.
Yeah. Slinks out of town. Gets the hell out of Dodge. Gets away with it for the time being.
So he gets a room at the local motel there. He didn't realize he was in Indiana until he saw the Indiana license plates from the cop's car. He was like, well, I guess this is where I landed.
Good way to figure it out.
Yeah, that 4 hours at the library trying
You'd
to figure out
how to... the mass expanse of nothing but cornfields would have given it away, but...
I mean, it's kind of hard to really hide amongst the cornfields, and he sort of discovered that when he checked into his motel. The lady that checked him in literally said to him, you aren't that skyjacker, are you?
Yeah, oh, I remember that. He's like, no, of course not.
Obviously not.
Why would I be getting a hotel?
Yeah. I'm not part of Van Halen. I don't... I'm not Kid Rock. I don't have that... I am from Detroit, but that blonde wig that I was wearing is not Kid Rock or otherwise.
I think he lost the wig in the... plane jump.
Yeah, the wind could have been bad.
Could have been?
D.B. Cooper's was 50 miles an hour, apparently.
Plus, like, you know.
You guys don't have wind in the Midwest. Oh, yes, you do. There's tornadoes. I'll see myself out. Eventually, he called his chauffeur buddy that was supposed to do the hijacking with him, but bailed, but agreed to the chauffeur. However, now he's doing it for free because, you know, Martin lost all the money. So that $25K he had promised him. So this is just a good friend.
Makes him less guilty.
Yeah.
No money?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, maybe.
Crime of the heart.
Good friends. So he calls his buddy. Buddy picks him up. He heads back to Detroit, and he is eventually arrested without incident.
But he evaded capture for over a week until, well, he was snitched on. He got ratted out, word got out, and...
his wig was not that good. They noticed him.
Yep, they knew it was Martin McNally, and the local cops came to get him.
And the last thing I will say about this weird, bizarre skyjacking saga, but mostly Martin McNally for now, is he escaped prison twice after being apprehended.
Yeah, the rest of Martin McNally's story is
same.
Phenomenal. Worth listening to American Skyjacker. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the story doesn't even come close to stopping there.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Yep.
So anyways, guys, thank you so much for listening. We won't do any skyjacking stories for like a while, but we were pretty into them for at least 3 weeks now. I just find it fascinating. And these guys' stories are just like, it's not just one thing. Like, McCoy, by the way, died in an FBI shootout they came to apprehend him. Just it's all crazy. Anyways, love you guys. Thank you so much for listening. And until next week, love you. Party on.